Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm pleased to have as my guest for the first time Tim Winton. He's the author of a new book of short stories called The Turning. He's a writer who was born in West Australia, and his novels include Dirt Music, The Riders, Cloud Street, several of which were shortlisted for the Booker Prize. He's also written two previous collections of stories and several books for younger readers. Now, this is a collection, as they say, of interlocking stories, but rather I found it to be essentially like the Nick Adams stories by Hemingway, a set of stories about a particular group of lives, one in particular, that of Vic, what is his last name? Lang.
Vic Lang, yeah.
Who's the child of a policeman who has left his city town, come to a small town, grown up there, and left again, and is in certain ways looking back on a life that's been full of a certain amount of sorrow that's left him in a kind of passive place while he actively protects in his now job as a defender the downtrodden. He's been identified from his earliest childhood with people who can be seen as victims, and the book has a large cast of characters of people who cast themselves as victims in a certain sense. And I wondered about that setting. Is it just the picture of the place, Angeles?
Yeah, I guess in a way it's me revisiting some of that for myself. But yeah, I guess I was writing about a milieu as much as a character, and I didn't set out to write a book of stories that related to each other. I just was enjoying going back and writing stories after not doing them for maybe 20 years. And they were my first love, and I loved the form. What happened is I just wrote one story, and I wrote another story thinking that it was a separate story, which it was, but it seemed to have dragged some air in from the last story. And I was writing about this place, particularly in the 1970s, under the kind of weird pressure of isolation, that small town pressure that you have, the new pressure of drugs coming into a small community, that sense of claustrophobia, the need to escape, the impossibility of escape, if you like. And many of these stories, when they do relate directly to Vic or from Vic's perspective, are mostly from looking back at from middle age. And I guess I became interested during the writing at how similar people are when they're sort of in the throes of middle age. It's where you're almost everything you are is a middle-aged person. Rethinking yourself seems so related to how you were as an adolescent. And there are times when people in middle age are acting like adolescents, or they're acting out their adolescence, or they're trying to drag themselves from their adolescence, or blaming their adolescence.
I noticed that there's a certain kind of clairvoyance in these stories. In the very first, the protagonist is working at a meatworks where the job principally involves hosing the blood off the floor. The blood is being fed into the bay, and he can see down where a bunch of codgers are fishing for herring, which congregate around the blood, and that he and his friend can see themselves stuck there, now graduated from the meatworks to codgerdom down below. And the stories seem to have that sense of people knowing their own fates, anticipating what's going to happen to them unless they make a radical shift, and finding that shift very hard to find a clue to.
Yeah, there is a sort of a sense of destiny in a small community. I think it's not quite as clear as it was, say, when I was a young man in a small community. There isn't that in a sense of implacable destiny. But certainly it's possible to see your life not mapped out, but you can see it, the shadings of it many years ahead, unless you get lucky or unless you suck it up and try something else out. And I guess, interestingly, in that story, you know, one really doesn't deep down want to leave, doesn't want to turn away from the life that's been mapped out for him. And the other does, rather desperately, and it's quite a sudden. I get to guess the way that the story ends. It ends in a kind of a moment of clairvoyance, if you like, as you put it. These two boys find themselves on the edge of a salt lake, hundreds of miles from their hometown, and just in that moment, sort of are able to sense how large and strange the world is. But within a matter of months, one of them's dead.
Now tell me, do you have, I don't know the right word, a credo for how to be true to people's lives? Because the respect and empathy seem to be the watchwords here. And, people, some of the people writing about your work in Australia, it's almost become a comic repetition. How can he achieve such levels of empathy? How does he know the sadness of so many different kinds of people? But it doesn't seem to be a matter so much of knowledge as of belief about what fiction is.
Oh, that's an interesting... I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, it's certainly not about knowledge. I can't claim to have suffered enough to have, that level of intimacy in order to be authoritative. It could only be instinct, I suspect, and interest. But I don't really have a credo. It's just I'm writing about the kinds of people who interest me and the kinds of people I grew up with and the kinds of people I live amongst even now, and really it doesn't get any more complicated than me addressing what interests me in treating it in a way that interests me in terms of craft without too much artifice. I mean, given that if you're writing and you're going to even utter the word craft, artifice is to the fore, but it's I suppose I like a kind of a plainness of accessibility, which is sly enough to seem simple, But the less you can think about that, the more successful you are at that.
It seemed as if one of the guiding principles is no overt tricks.
Yeah, well, anybody who ever read Carver, we had that emblazoned on our foreheads. And yet, I have written books that some people have said, had plenty of magical realist moments in them, and yet it's the way that you treat those things anyway. I don't know. I guess I came from a kind of working class background. I went to university. I was the first person in my family to finish school, and I guess being confronted by the all the sophistications of literary theory and the grand tradition that, you know, that we inherit and dispute and avoid and dis. I guess I was trying to find over years trying to marry what I'd learnt as an educated person with what I knew instinctively and socially, as somebody from the working class, where story was valued, but there was no tolerance for this great divorce between the teller and the listener. Things weren't told with contempt in the way that that kind of contempt that entered storytelling with the modernists, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you're essentially telling stories or writing fiction or painting for the boobs out there. You know, the fools, the Philistines who don't know any better. And the harder you make it for them, the better you're going to feel about yourself. So I guess I was trying to find some way of writing literary fiction that didn't pander to literary sensibility and didn't pander to a mass sensibility. So I guess in a way, unless I'm in a situation like this where I'm forced to talk about it, I don't really address the issues in such abstract terms. I'm mostly working story to story, character to character, too self-obsessed by the need to figure out the problem on the page to wonder about what it is I'm actually doing, how I see myself, what it is that I am, except a tradesman trying to make a living without shame.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Tim Winton, author most recently of The Turning, published by Scribner. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tim Winton about his new book of stories, The Turning. Now, it seemed to me that while, of course, it's true that while you're arm-wrestling a story, you're not thinking of the grander themes, and yet stamina, it seemed to me, the stamina to keep alive under difficult circumstances, but also simultaneously the stamina to get a story written, to take a story through its points of pain and come to the end, seems to be a principal concern. What prevents people from committing suicide? How do they make what few changes that they can? In a certain way, with the title The Turning, it's almost as if rethinking a life, which is like revising a story, becomes a subject here. You know, how do we get this down on the page against all the odds that say we want a happy ending? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a milieu that I'm working with where people are find themselves offered, you know, very few alternatives, actually, I was a friend of mine, American poet Liam Rector, has a poem, and I forget the title of it, but there's a line in it that says, "Change is slow, and hope is violent." And I guess in a way, even though I read that line a year after I'd published the book, I was struck by it as to as to how few, in some circumstances, how few the possibilities for change and renewal and redemption in that sort of tawdry literary sense that we always have to use, how meager our opportunities are sometimes for escape or for change, but they do present themselves if they're recognized, and they can be, you know, just moments where somebody has the chance to reflect and to pull back or to push on or to persist or to desist, and thereby hang so much of these people's lives, and I suppose in my own life, you know, things have gone that way as well. And I suppose if I've ever felt any pressure, apart from being, you know, apart from the pressure of a sort of tawdry celebrity that you can very easily achieve on an island, I mean, Australians are islanders, there's only 20 million of us.
Yes, and you've been chosen to be a national living treasure.
Yeah, I can barely sleep at night for the thrill of that. But, sometimes there is this pressure to write in a grander manner about bigger things, and the underlying assumption is that the kinds of lives that most of us are leading, and the kinds of lives that I've been writing about, are therefore somehow not up to the mark. They're not worthy of wrinkling your brow over and trying to write serious stories about. So in that sense, I guess I have been stubborn and I have persisted in writing time and time again, actually about the same kinds of communities and the same kinds of people, partly because that's what I know about, but partly because I'm a little dogged about it. The more people tell me to write about more sophisticated people, the less likely I am to oblige.
Now, one of the things that makes these stories haunting is a sense of repetitions. Many of the stories feature characters who are watching one another secretly and have been watching for years, so that in addition to the action of the stories, we get a sense of a community of people, of starers, really, and of people who've looked at each other as potential models. You know, this might have been my life. I might live like that. I might like to marry him. Oh, I'm glad I didn't marry her. Look at her now. You know, this kind of ongoing sense of tellers at what they've been staring at. I wondered about that.
Well, that modeling idea is interesting because now that most of us live in more diffuse kind of communities, or even in virtual communities, our modeling and our staring becomes deeply impersonal, and you know, we're staring all the time at people who barely exist, who are sort of constructs, and we're modeling ourselves on people who've been scripted, you know, from the president down. And as well, we have this strange anxiety about the loss of privacy. And yet anybody who's lived in a small community knows that there is no privacy except what you carry between your ears, and if you're lucky, what happens in the bedroom, which, you know, is only deeply contingent on how lucky you are. But, there is this sense of by which in a small community you are being watched all the time and are strangely accountable and strangely self-conscious. But where you learn from other people without actually even having intimate contact with them, without even being a part of their life, you're a part of their life by watching them throughout their whole life. And you feel people as part of your life by being watched by them. It's a strange corollary to community, you know, both in its chilling and in its more warming senses.
Well, I want to describe a particular effect. I'm talking to Tim Winton, and we're talking about his book of stories, The Turning, because it's quite lovely. There's a very brief story called Immunity.
Yeah.
And a woman... reminds us that she's been watching this man. She's seen him in a window. We know from a previous story that he's been holding a rifle, and it's not quite clear who he intends to shoot, himself or the people in the sights of the rifle. In the previous story, it's been a while before he's put the ammunition clip in, but she thinks he's been holding an oar. And what's more, in this story, we don't even know who this woman is, who's the speaker here.
Yeah.
And that is part of the great interest of this book, that as you read along, you come to know as a reader more than these characters know, or slightly less, but in an interesting way. And that's what made it more than just a conventional Winesburg, Ohio set of linked stories. There was something happening on the level of the writing that brought you to a kind of grave and haunted place, I thought.
Well, that's lovely of you to say so. It's not as if the stories are merely interlinked. They sort of lean upon one another in oblique kinds of ways. And after the fact, I also realized that they were more than the sum of their parts as a normal collection of stories. And so there were things that you would learn accidentally about characters through the progress of the stories, and you would learn more about the town. You would learn, and so much knowledge was kind of gradual and retrospective, or sudden and retrospective, that sometimes totally changed a story that you'd read previously, or put such a different slant on it that it's for me the experience of reading it was very like the experience of writing it. All these things were accidental, apart from a bit of last draft tweaking where I was just enhancing the accidental glory of it. It's very similar to the reading process is very similar to how it was discovered on the page for me, and so I feel pretty lucky in that sense. It's definitely a triumph of instinct over intellect, but there was never a fair equation.
Now, many of these stories involve characters who've found at a certain point a spiritual dimension to their lives. Some of them have become sober. Some of them are striving too successfully to be sober, which means that they've been repressing everything and hiding virtually, coming virtually out of the woods in order to re-enter life. But there is a greater sense in this that both the characters and their writers sense a spiritual dimension of life that must be sought, even if not found. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I guess it's a peculiar... Australia and the States are cosmetically similar. I mean, there is a radical difference between them in that Australia is a deeply secular culture, and even given the irony that it's a culture grafted onto the oldest continent which had produced the oldest and longest civilization and religious culture ever. I mean, the Australian Aborigines, in all their groups, go back 40, perhaps 60,000 years. They had the first monotheism. They have the oldest art. In a strange way, it's the most religious continent on the globe. And in my culture, which is barely more than 200 years old, which supplanted that culture, secularism and a deep distaste for religious thinking, religious institutions, any kind of establishment, any kind of high-toned behavior because we were convicts involuntary migrants, shall we say. There was this deep suspicion and hatred of the church and of religious institutions because the church was collaborating in their incarceration, and so it's left us with a pretty dour, strong physical culture, which has helped us to endure as a settler culture, if you like. And the traditional strengths of settler culture are a muscular, resourceful, physically capable culture. But with blinkers, in order to survive, you don't think, you don't meditate, you don't wonder because you can't afford it. There isn't time. In my lifetime, my culture has changed enormously, and people like Patrick White and painters and composers that came around him and after him had an enormous impact on dragging people away from that rigidity of survival. And I think we are at a time, even though we're suspicious and cynical and dour and pessimistic, where it's now impossible not to confront not just the past and what it means to be a supplanting culture, but just what it means to be alive and have a life of the mind and allow yourself a life of the mind. So for me, I guess the accidental, unwitting project of my work over 25 years has been confronting that aching need at the heart of a successful material culture that yearns for more. I mean, we have a very successful middle class, safe, secure culture that just needs something more, and it's a meaning that can't be got at a chain store. It can't be got in politics. It's a spiritual hunger that it can barely be mentioned. It's the hunger that dare not speak its name. But speak we will.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I've been speaking with Tim Winton, author most recently of The Turning, published by Scribner. Thank you, Tim, for joining me.
My pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.